Welcome to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. My name's Theo Finnegan and I'm talking to Yoichi Mukai from Modern Languages Studies at VIU. On Friday, October 18th, from 10 till 11:30 in the Malaspina Theatre, Yoichi will give a presentation titled All Things Language, Linguistics of VIU. In this talk, he'll discuss two initiatives, the Linguistic Research Lab and the Linguistics of the Day activities in the courses Yoichi teaches. Dr. Yoichi Mukai joined Modern Languages Studies at VIU in 2019. He earned his MA in Applied Linguistics and Discourse Studies from Carleton University in 2014, and his PhD in Linguistics from the University of Alberta in 2020. His research employs a range of experimental methods to study how humans process spoken language. Hi Yoichi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Of course. So you're going to be talking in your colloquium presentation about one thing you'll talk about is the Linguistic Research Lab at VIU. Could you tell me a little bit about the origins of the lab and maybe what it's for?
So the Linguistic Research Lab is founded through the CFI and the BCKDF, I got the funding. Yeah, awarded to me and Dr. Marla Morden from the psychology department. Yeah, and the project was Vancouver Island Eye Tracking Hub, creating regional capacity for evidence-based non-invasive cognitive assessment. That was the name of the project. Yeah, basically, I wanted to have the eye tracker to do my research. Yeah. And then I contacted the research office. And then they introduced the Dr. Mara Morden from psychology department because she was also interested in eye tracking study. And then in particular, like particular technique of the eye tracking study that I'm interested in, she was also interested in it too. Yes. So
how does that eye tracking technology work and what does it help you understand?
We can see what's going on in your mind. Eye movement tells you a lot what's going on in your mind, like how long you look at it, or like I look at the pupil dilation as well, but how much pupil dilates, that's corresponding to the your mental effort. Wow. For example, when you're thinking a lot, when you're using a lot of the resources on your mind, then your pupil to dilate more. And then when you're reading something, and if you're having a difficulty comprehending sentence or word per se, you fixate longer. Well, the kind of subtle differences actually tells quite a bit. So we cannot open our head and look at it. So we try to do them more like indirect way to see what's going on.
Replicants are like,
you know, the first thing that made me think of was
they're either a benefit or a
Blade hazard. Runner. You know the film Blade Runner?
There are benefits
Problem. Where one of the ways, different question? In a way, but one of the ways they can tell if someone is a replicant, so like an AI robot, is through an eye tracking test.
That is a risk.
Is this to be an empathy test? Capillary dilation of the so-called blush response? Fluctuation of the pupil? Involuntary dilation of the iris.
We call it Voight Kampff for short.
Mr. Deckard, Dr. Eldon Terrell.
Demonstrate it. I want to see it work.
Where's the subject?
I want to see it work on a person. I want to see a negative before I provide you with a positive.
What's that going to prove?
Indulge me.
On you?
Try her.
I'm saying that's not what you're doing, but there's a scene in the 1982, like the original film, a great scene where the detective comes in and he's testing a bunch of workers at the company just because they want to find out, because these robots are kind of going a little haywire and they're criminals basically. And so they use the Voight Kampff test, and it's dilation of the pupil. The science fiction has also been telling us that tells us a lot about what people are thinking or who they are even.
Right. Yeah. Used to be eye tracker was quite expensive. Still expensive, to be honest. But nowadays, even like a gaming computer, gaming laptop has an eye tracker
Really?
already included. So that in my case, I wanted to have the quite sophisticated. Let's say I want to take the like a little picture, like let's say 1,000 hertz, for example, or like 250 hertz, or like a lot of stuff. But I guess it doesn't need to be that high when it comes to playing gaming, but
Right.
just for the experiment purposes, it's good
Yes.
to have the high quality. But yes, so eye tracking study, it's been popular, but unfortunately, VIU didn't have that capacity a long time. So that and then yeah, Dr. Marla and I, we applied, and then we got like funding for that, and we were able to acquire the portable eye tracking technology. So that we are trying to, and then my linguistic researcher, I wish that my lab gonna be the hub of the like interdisciplinary with the eye tracking study, so that we don't have to go to like Vancouver or like a mainland, or even Victoria has that the same technology too, but
Yes.
a little bit difficult to go over there, do the data, not collection, and then come back and all that.
As you say, you sort of collaborated, or there's an interdisciplinary component with psychology. And so, would you be, broadly speaking, looking for different things, or how would, say, a psychologist use it as opposed to a linguist?
To me, I'm interested in language processing. For psychologists, whatever they are interested in, they can look at it through the eye movement or pupil dilation, or like how long they look at the particular picture, for example. So just we shared a lot of methodology, but what we are looking at is just a different thing. Basically, linguists, we are borrowing a lot of the methodology from different disciplines. I happen to be phonetician in this psycholinguist, so that that's why what I do is quite related to what they do. Another benefit of the our eye tracking study is that we got the latest model,
Oh, cool.
yay! So it's a portable, so that we can bring it to anywhere.
I was going to actually ask what it looks like.
There's a big box of the camera, and then we're gonna attach to the laptop. They are basically calculating the location of the gaze or pupil size based on the reflection of the. I'm not an engineer, so I don't know how all the things are working, but yeah, quite small. And then just I need two laptops, one for the eye tracking, the other one for the controlling that eye tracking camera. And then basically, participants want to sit in front of the laptop, and then they do particular tasks given by the experimenter. And while they are doing the task, we measure like the pupil or pupil dilation or gaze location on the screen, and how long they look at the particular part of the screen. And then let's say if you're bilingual, if you speak two languages, when you think of the word in one language, does it activate same word in a different language? A lot of experiment that I do could be done by looking at the reaction time, give the participant the task to do, and then they do the task, and then we measure how fast it is. And then usually that speed tells us something. But instead of looking at the reaction time, we look at the eye, in this case, fixation duration, for example. Longer looking at it, that means that there's additional processing going on, for example.
It tells you if someone's kind of doing multitasking almost.
We have a lot of the independent variables to look at. And then if we look at the one particular variable, and if that independent variable has an effect on the fixation duration, that means that the word from the other languages should be activated. That's why we are seeing the effect.
If you're having those two the two languages working at the same time as you're bilingual, does that slow you down or speed you up?
One of the independent variable that I look at was a frequency effect. the more common the word is, easier to access, right? So for example, dog in English, and then I don't speak French, but the chien, the frequency, like how common the word dog is and how common the word chien is slightly different. Like when you're processing a dog, seems like a frequency effect of the chien is actually helping. That means that when dog is activated in your mind, chien is somewhat activating as well, even though that's nothing to do with what you are doing at the moment.
If you're doing more than one thing, surely that's going to make it harder, but it sounds like what it's doing is...
In a way, helping.
Yeah. I don't know how true this is either, but a kind of a cliche almost of, you know, learning multiple languages when you're little, like being raised bilingual, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard or read in general that that makes learning other languages, I don't know if easier is the right word, but maybe there's more facility for languages the more you do, even though that's more information.
Yeah, exactly. That's a kind of difficult to think about. Mm-hmm. You are raising the very, very good point. You know, like I assume you know a lot of words. So like you're a professor, so you know 30, 40, 50,000. Does that mean you have a lot of words in your head? Does that make it difficult for you to access a particular word because you have too many candidates in it? But still, you read fast, and you still read faster than someone like who are not having as many as words. So, how do you think words are organized in our head? That's one of the questions that I'm planning to ask in my presentation. But yeah, like.
Again, speaking as a non-expert, just with a general sense of things, that it's not the case that, you just get too full up and then that's a problem, as opposed to like the idea of, I don't know what the metaphor would be, but almost like more not a container, but a network.
Hi, my name's Theo and I teach in the English department at Vancouver Island University. You're listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM Nanaimo.
If I go through a period of not reading novels, for instance, like in the summer, if I'm taking some time off and I'm like, I don't want to read because it's my job usually to read. So I take some time and just watch TV or whatever, do nothing. I find just anecdotally from my experience that I feel a bit slower. I feel like I'm not sharp. I feel like I have to kind of get back on the horse, like get a little more like preparing for teaching. Whereas I find if I'm almost like exercising, like if I'm reading a lot, it makes it easier, as it were.
Writing is a little different from the speaking because language could exist without a written form. So that like a natural language that we acquire as a baby and all that, that's a little different from the writing and the reading. But if we see language acquisition as a skill, like the same as you learn how to walk or how to run. And in that case, the more you do, better at it. Like a connection itself as your network, the connection
gets
stronger.
Right.
So that the knowledge you have about the word, for example, that knowledge itself becomes, we call it like a declarative knowledge, like implicit, as I like to say, so that you don't have to think about it to access it. But you don't need to know how to run, how to move your muscle to run it, because you know how to do it.
Mm.
But you can't explain what exactly you are doing, but you know you can do it. If you're learning a second language, third language, fourth language, for example, I guess, the muscle, learning the language becomes more implicit, becomes like internalized so that you don't have to think about how to learn it. Individual speaker, each one has a different history of like interaction with languages, and then when to learn the new language, and yeah, kind of difficult to control that part, like intersection of the social science and then humanity, and then more like the science itself. Very like we can approach to the qualitative way as well as the quantitative way, but just very difficult to hit the nice middle ground. And then we want to be more practical about it so that we can actually help the teacher and the learner of the language as well. But if we go too far that way, again, experimentally, it's not scientific enough, or like not systematic enough. If we do that too much, it's not, it's kind of too far from the actual real world. Like, you know, we are not living in the ideal world, so that because just a single pronunciation of the word, like the word, I mean, the way I pronounce the word, I have accent, but every time I pronounce slightly different.
So I pronounce the word differently according to who I'm talking to. Because if I'm in Canada, my New Zealand accent kind of disappears. If I talk to my parents, it comes back. And so I might say word, and then I'll say word, and it's a sort of subconscious thing. I'll say word here.
One of the activities that I do in my linguistic class is the linguistics of the day activity. And that's like a fun fact about language. And then, as you mentioned about like dialect, like a different kind of languages and all that. So like Canada has a, Canadian English has a, like a specific way to say, I've done my homework, or I am done.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm done might depend a bit, but I'm done my homework.
I'm done my homework. It's fine. Good for you. Good. Acceptable for you.
Yeah.
I'm done with my homework. Or I've done my homework.
I feel like you would say it might depend on the situation, right? Where you would say, I've done my homework. I feel like that's almost, it depends, but that would that be a, that might be a response to a specific question of, have you done your
homework? Yeah, right, right. So I'm done with my homework. So do you need a with?
Like, no.
Is it the?
Yeah, I don't think so.
So you never say I'm done with my homework.
I feel like you might see to me, and just my perspective, I'm done with my homework. It almost sounds more like, exasperation.
You are tired of it?
So yeah, like, maybe.
Done with it?
But whereas I'm done, my homework is like, oh, I'm done. Let's go do something.
Finished.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like that kind of difference. Like Canada. Oh, so you say, I have done my homework. I've done my homework. That's perfectly fine, right?
Yeah.
I've done.
Yeah, yeah.
So it seems like I'm done part. That's a very much Canadian. So that so American doesn't like that.
Really?
So like, what about I'm finished my homework?
Yeah.
Yeah, American doesn't like that.
Really?
Unacceptable. Yeah.
What do they say?
I've done.
Oh, they do. Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And the British people doesn't like that either. So very much Canadian way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of like I gave that kind of question to the students and just discussing in class, what do you think about it? Nothing is like wrong, like, you know, this is right, this is wrong. Like think about something that we never think about.
So in your the blurb for your presentation, just as a last question, you have a line where you say you're aiming to raise awareness of the often overlooked complexity of and assumptions
about
how we use language. And I was going to finish by asking, so what's one example of an overlooked thing that we just tend to overlook that linguistics can help us understand, maybe?
Yeah, like something like this, you as a native speaker, you know what is acceptable, what is not.
Right.
You can tell, but you don't know why it's acceptable. So, and then basically we go through why it is acceptable, why it is not acceptable. Basically the implicit knowledge you have to determine this is acceptable or not.
So I find sometimes when I'm talking about grammar with students, in the writing center, for instance. And I'm very good at grammar practical, like I know how to do it. And then sometimes when I'm like, well, why is this the way it is? I'm like, well, I'm not sure. Partly because of how I learned English, I think that it, you know,
never
really taught as like, here are the rules. You just kind of do it for a while. There is a lot of implicit language knowledge there. There's a reason for these things. So there would be a reason that Americans don't like, I'm done.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. In that case, I don't know. But you feel one sentence is better than the other.
Yeah.
Like in that context as well. And why that's the case? Well, a lot of the cases are basically the frequency, how common that is. Probability of the whatever the word it is, and then the one the next, basically that commonality as well. But yeah, that can the implicit knowledge you have, and then you think you know what it is, but you can't explain it. So that in linguistics, usually we give the descriptive. Like a description of why that's the case. That's the thing. Yeah, that's the purpose of the linguistics of the day that I do at the beginning of the class every time as an icebreaker. Like students really like it because
it's really interesting. It makes you think. I like that kind of thing where you take something that you just do and then think about
students tend to get very interested in that one, but sometimes we have to study the content of the textbook, but they're interested in that kind of stuff as well. But quite a lot of the activities, like a short activities that I do about why you like one over the other, and I can explain that. Like a quick example would be, so if you create a new word by blending two words, like a bug, like insect,
yes,
and then a cat, which one of the following words will you create? Bat or butt?
Oh, I see.
So you have a bug, cat, you want to put them together.
Which one are you going to choose? Is it going to be
So you want to bat or butt?
Is there an answer to that? Or does it depend?
Yeah. You usually you want to go for the bat.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 80% of the people go for that.
What's the short answer about why?
Because of the syllable structure for the each word. Yeah, there's a particular. You prefer to retain the syllable structure of these two words rather than breaking down the components of it, so that you ended up going for the bad. Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. Yuichi, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed talking to you. It's really interesting. And
Thank you.
I can't wait to see your colloquium presentation. Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Yuichi Mukai for joining me in conversation. Technical production by Robin Davies. Music by Greg Bush. The Colloquium series will be back in November 2024 with a presentation by Magnolia Porker from Studies in Women and Gender at VIU titled Philosophy Now, Genealogies of Philosophical Journalism and the Question of the Present. For more information, go to ah.viu.ca and click on Colloquium series. My name's Theo Finnegan. Thanks for listening.